Welcome to the Next Brave Thing podcast. My name is Ella Hooper, and I believe that breakthrough is on the other side of bravery. This podcast features brave stories, emotional health, and creativity to inspire you to take your next brave step. Today on the episode, I have some of my favorite people, David and Lisa Noronha. Thank you for joining.
Great to be here.
Yeah, it's a special day today. I was feeling all the feels as I was driving here because I've had 7 or 8 years. Is it 8 years?
8 years.
Probably eight years
mm-hmm. of doing life with these amazing people.
We've watched you grow up, Ella.
Yeah. And I've watched you grow up.
That is fair.
That was very kind of you.
We have the honor and privilege of watching each other evolve and grow, change.
Amen.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's really special that we've had this long journey. And they are the co-founders of Bethel Conservatory of the Arts. And I've had the great privilege of first being mentored and interning for David Noronha, and then coming alongside and helping build Bethel Conservatory of the Arts. They have 4 amazing kids, Zion, Knight, Isaiah, and Talita. And mm-hmm. Talita is the same age as Bethel Conservatory of the Arts.
Yes, she is.
We've watched her grow up. We've watched our school grow up. It's just very, very special.
Get out of diapers, start walking. Yeah. I'm talking about the school, but yeah.
Well, yes. And it's funny, they take on their own personality.
Yes, they do.
We'd love to mold and shape the personality mm-hmm. of our child, Bethel Conservatory of the Arts.
She has a will of her own.
She has a will of her own. Yes, it's very real. And yeah, it's such an honor to be on the podcast with you and just share with my audience who you are, because you're very significant people to me. One of my favorite stories you share, and the students love it. We all love it. And I never get bored of hearing it, is how did you guys meet? Can you tell us the story?
Once upon a time,
I think
there was a boy and a girl in New York City.
New York City, everyone.
Yeah, it was already pretty. So, I mean, my quick setup POV was I had just graduated from conservatory. I had taken like a 3-day workshop as a bartender because my goal was to not be a waiter as an actor. And I thought, let me be like Tom Cruise in Cocktail. So I took this 3-day thing. I was like barely 21. So I barely served any drinks, but I had like a Rolodex, a little box with cards and recipes. And there was this gay Canadian guy who had been getting his green card and he was on his way out. So the job for bartender was, you know what I'm saying?
That
green card. Not the gay Canadian part, but yes.
Yeah.
And so my buddy says to me, hey man, 2 things. Number one, there's a job as a bartender opening up. Number two, there's this girl, and I think she's your type. Cut to you.
Yes, that is me. I am the girl. I am the girl. Yeah, I was working at the restaurant.
I was working as a waitress in a
yes. Because I had already been in New York for like 3 or 4 years. And at that point, I decided, you know, I'm going to take a year off from auditioning and working and put myself through acting school. So that's what I did for a year. I dedicated myself to staying in the city for a year to study acting.
What school did you go to?
It was a Meisner program.
Was it the one I did?
No, unfortunately.
No. Okay.
Because it was a while ago.
Yeah.
But and so, yeah, that's what I was doing. And yeah, I remember one afternoon, I was in the restaurant and I turned around and this really hot guy walked through the door. And
and then David walked in after.
Oh,
just kidding.
Well, no, ironically enough, a fellow waiter walked in, and he walked in with David. Mm. And I didn't know him very well, and so I clocked David, going, "Oh, okay, hot, amazing guy." And honestly, the second thought I had is like, "And he's probably gay."
Yeah, like a lot
of. And it certainly wasn't because of my wardrobe, because I looked like one of the reject wardrobe guys from like Friends, an episode of Friends. I had like a mustard plaid.
It was very nice.
Frayed, cut off. Yeah, yeah. Look at the stinky face.
It sounds crazy now, but that's kind of the style then. You know what I mean? It was the style.
So then fast forward, one day I was changing into the uniform, which of course, circa mid-90s was acid wash denim, button-up shirts as a waiter, and then black jeans. So I had hopped on the subway from Queens, coming from my apartment, and I go downstairs. I clock that she's there. We had kind of been eyeing each other for a couple of weeks. I go down to the lockers. They had these lockers down in the basement, and I was changing into my denim shirt. So I had to take off my shirt, and Danielle, the gay Canadian bartender, was down there. He leaves abruptly, and then, like, I'm not joking, 45 seconds later, out of breath, dum, 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 comes this one. I'm just buttoning the shirt, and she's like, hi. And I'm like, you know, abs out, and I button it. She's like, hi. And that's when I finally got the guts to ask her out. But what did Danielle say?
Danielle and I were actually roommates.
Oh, wow.
At the time. And he was like, oh my goodness, Lisa, you've got to get down there right now and see that guy's body. You would not believe his abs. So I was like, okay. And apparently it was loud, me running down the stairs.
Apparently.
I thought I was being casual.
No, she was stealth.
But we had been flirting back and forth over the little bar for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
So leading up to this moment.
Yeah.
And so then, like he said, he finally got the nerve to ask.
Asked her to an Irish pub. Coolest thing about her is I had two Guinnesses. She had one. And I was like, a girl who can hang and have a Guinness with me. We talked for probably.
Wait, that's the coolest thing about
her? No. Well, a couple things. I had dated dancers. So a girl who could eat and drink a beer with me and have great conversation and look like her. I was like, oh, man, I'm finished. So on that first night. This bar, Sorelli's, this Italian restaurant, which is now a Citibank that you can walk into. And we walked from First Avenue all the way across the island to Hell's Kitchen on like 9th.
Oh, wow. That's a long walk.
Long way. That's
pretty much the entire. Yeah.
Yeah.
Epic date. We ended up on Madison. Yeah. There was like outdoor fountains and like an episode of Friends. We actually just hopped into the fountain. Another couple hopped in and we kind of played around.
It's like crazy. A movie.
It really is. And then we walked into a bodega and I bought her a sunflower, which to this day is kind of our flower.
Oh, sweet. Yeah.
So that was the first date.
But guys, the course of true love never runs smooth. Then what happened?
Well, it was hot and steamy for what, 3 weeks?
Yeah.
Passion on passion.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know, you just wanted a relationship at the time. And after like, right?
So at the beginning, I was a train wreck. She had her stuff together. I did not. She could smell it from like, you know, a mile away. And she's like, hey, you've got some things to figure out. You remember?
Right. Yeah. But that's what I'm thinking. Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Yeah. But I kept thinking about her. So, I mean, literally there was like probably a year after the hot and steamy beginning, there was like a year where she really didn't, we had no contact, but I kept thinking about her.
Right.
And then one day.
Yes.
My pager goes off because that's, my pager.
Yes.
Beep, 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 beep. And I get this number.
And you stinker.
What?
You're a stinker.
So
because you did some investigating.
I did.
To investigate.
So I get the pager number.
Now we investigate through Instagram. We stalk people.
No, there's no stalking in this.
So what did investigating look like?
Exactly. So I had my 1-800 pager because I was super cool. So you could page me anywhere in the country. I thought that was really cool.
Which was good because I was in Canada at the time.
True. Oh. I didn't know that. So I get a number. Area code I don't recognize, and like a little extension. So I think, oh, maybe it's like my agent, my manager, an audition, because that's what actors think everything's about. Yeah. So I call, and the concierge or whatever front desk says, New Brunswick Hotel. Well, we're in New York, so I'm thinking New Brunswick, New Jersey. So I was like, New Brunswick, New Jersey? No, New Brunswick, Canada. I was like, Canada. I was like, all right, well, I've got this 3-digit extension. She's like, oh, that's a room number, sir. I said, listen, can you tell me who's in the room? And she says, well, a so-and-so or a Lisa Marie. And I said, put me through. So the thing rings. She answers, hi. And I'm like, Lisa Marie. And she's like, how'd you know it was me? I said, I have my ways. <That's> so cheesy.
I fell for it because I was the one trying to get a hold of him.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Basically a year had gone by and I thought, well, you know, let me check in with him and see if he's gotten his act together.
Yeah.
And I kind of
because neither
of,
one of us stopped thinking about each other, honestly.
You
know what I mean? So. And I was on tour and I was like, listen, I'm going to be in New York in like 2 weeks. You want to meet up?
And I was like, heck yeah.
Lunch or something?
Yeah, but it was late. And I still remember the first time I saw her after a year, she crossed the street out by my place on the West End. And she was in a brown and white dress with little spaghetti straps. And I said, dang, this girl is unbelievable. And that was kind of it. I mean, from there on out, we just kind of hopped into life. So, And we have now been together almost 30 years, married 26 this summer coming
up. This summer will be 26 years.
Yeah.
Together.
Four kids, almost Amish. Those two hot kids cranked out four babies.
Yeah, we like to think about that. Like, you remember us back at Sorelli's? Like, would we have ever thought our life is what it is?
No. No.
Would anybody around us believe it? No.
That's crazy.
But by the grace of God.
Yeah, life can change so much. So you guys are artists, performers, creatives. David, what's your favorite performance of Lisa's?
Oh, yeah. No, I know in a second. So she was doing West Side Story National Tour. She was one of the sharks. And in one of the major dance numbers, there's this girl who comes out in a red dress. I mean, this red dress is so hot, so stunning that the lead that was playing Anita, who I actually went to school with, who was actually on the same tour, fought and got pissed at the wardrobe mistress because Lisa got the dress. And I just remember I was thinking about at that time, I think we were already engaged. I had the ring and she came out in that red dress. It just took my breath away. Actually, one of my regrets is that I didn't see her play Mary Magdalene in Jesus Christ Superstar when she was out on tour.
But he stood me up because I had a ticket waiting for him at the box office because he said he was coming out to see me. And that ticket just sat there and he didn't show up. But that's okay.
I was trying to make a go with a girlfriend that I was with at the time. I was trying to be responsible.
Yeah.
And then she haunted me in all the best ways. And I actually cut it off with that girl shortly after.
Yeah. But I, as a woman, girl, that feeling of being stood up. Oh my gosh. So painful.
Oh yeah. Because I had reached out to him. We had a nice connect in New York. And I said, listen, I'll be in Connecticut doing the show. I'd like you to come see me the show. And he's like, oh my goodness, that'd be great. And we had a wonderful time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So when he like didn't show up, I was like, oh my.
Yeah.
Oh.
I don't use the word regret a lot. Honestly, I don't use it lightly. She knows this. That's one of them.
Totally. That's one of them. I mean, I think, that's so part of relationships. Mm-hmm. though. And I think because seeing you 25, 30, what did you say?
30 years together, 26 married this summer. Yeah.
Well, 30 years later, I think those big moments feel like they're going to be the rest of your life in those moments. But it's beautiful to have perspective of like actually a very committed, healthy marriage now, like all these years later.
Well, it's interesting because I didn't wait very long to find out why he didn't come. Right? Yeah. It's not like, oh, he didn't show and I just kind of sat there and wept. No, I kind of got on the phone. It was like, what happened? What's going on? And it was actually quite a beautiful story. You know, he just said, well, I wanted to be honest with you. So I had to go, you know, cut it off with somebody first. And that is a beautiful romantic story because who did you call that night?
Oh, man, this was epic. Yeah, at the time I went to go see my old college girlfriend because we had gotten back in a relationship. When we walked away from each other, when she said, hey, go clean up your mess, I did what most guys do, which is run back to an individual that I was familiar with.
Yeah.
Good person, just, you know, dysfunctional relationship. And so I went to go see her in a show and it was catastrophic for both of us. So literally, like out of a stupid Hallmark film, I'm in a phone booth calling my mother collect in tears going, I don't know what to do. And she's like, honey, you've got to end this. You've got to end this relationship. You got to get on that train tomorrow. You got to make the hard decision and you need to move forward in life, you know, because I had told her about Lisa. And so, yeah, my mom was the one who gave me the advice. And literally I'm in a train with my ex, like crying outside of the train. And I went to New York and then soon thereafter we hopped into a relationship. So yeah, phone booth and tears and rain.
So thanks to David's mom for giving him some good advice.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, mom.
Who now lives in Reading.
She does. She does.
Yeah.
Wild. Life is wild.
It is.
And I think that's just from knowing you guys, seeing so much all things working together for good.
Yep.
And things turning around and the messy things being made beautiful. And I
100%.
Love that. It's so beautiful. What's your favorite performance of David's?
That's a good question. Well, actually, so when he brings up the red dress, that's the first time he saw me perform.
Okay.
Ever. And I remember standing backstage telling the cast members, like, this is the first time my fiance has ever seen me perform. And they're like, what? He's your fiance? You guys are getting married and he's never seen you perform? And I'm like, no.
Because isn't there like a moment in where you come out in the dress?
It's well, like yeah, exactly. You kind of chenet onto the stage,
yes.
Right, really fast. That's so that's the first thing he sees is me, you know, twirling onto the stage. So literally the first time he saw me on stage. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, it was magical.
But the first time I actually saw him do a show, it was, I don't know if it was like downtown in the Village or something. It was called Popol Vuh, right?
Gosh, good memory. Yeah, yes, it was this Popol weird Vuh. Incan Indian piece with me like kind of wearing like a diaper on stage.
Yeah, it was
horrible. It was honestly horrible.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was fun.
Yeah.
That was fun to see him doing, because I was like, I barely knew him. And I was like, and he was like this actor, you know? From Carnegie Mellon University. And I was like, oh, okay, this is different. This is fun. And then I don't know if I actually ever saw you in Love, Valor, and Compassion.
No, you didn't.
But what I do remember about Love, Valor, Compassion, and talk about like the girl and the romantic thing, is they had a fire escape on the outside of the theater.
The Walter Kerr, like, Broadway theater.
New York. Yeah. They have those big fire escapes. And he was a swing or understudy in the show. So he had to be at the theater even when he wasn't performing. So one night I met him there and we snuck out to the fire escape together as the show was going on.
Oh, that's
and
so fun.
We had a little, you know, a little connect.
A little moment.
Yeah. And then I think there on out, you kind of went into like TV land, you know,
yeah,
a lot
I
of
think
TV stuff. So
there was a moment in West Side where I was getting ready to give you the ring. You didn't know that. And she was actually off stage in Colorado in the wings. And she had asked... one of the guys to put Mrs. Santa Claus on TV because it was premiering. It was this TV musical that I'd done with Angela Lansbury. So imagine she's about to go out on stage and I'm having kind of like my broadcast television debut. And I think I think you said to everybody, that's my fiance. That's my fiance on TV.
Yeah. Everybody was like, what? You know, and like every time we're off stage, we run back and we're watching it.
So, yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
Sweet moments.
I mean, I've had many moments of seeing you guys in just amazing. I mean, as you're kind of sharing, I'm thinking of the first moment I saw you dance, and it was the first year of BCA's auditions.
Mm.
And I was like jaw to the ground. I think you were doing just a basic jazz routine. But I was like, you know, when you'd see someone for, I think probably a year and a half, I'd known you by then, but then I saw you get up and it was so like, I don't even have the words for it, but it was so striking and so much authority and excellence. And like, I was just taken aback. And I just, you're a woman who constantly surprises, like, well, cause you, Lisa is not a bragger. She doesn't like promote herself. So when she just comes out and does something, you're like, what was that? You know? So I haven't actually seen you perform other than like seen you through the classroom leading moments.
This is true.
But I don't know, when you dance, it's pretty striking.
Oh,
it's
wow.
pretty amazing.
Yes.
But David, my favorite performance of yours, I've seen a lot of yours because they're on TV.
Yeah.
The Mentalist, my favorite, One Tree Hill.
Yes.
Jack Ryan. But I, what was the most moving experience was watching you and our friend Hunter Odom in Of Mice and Men.
Yeah.
So Of Mice and Men.
Yeah.
And that was incredible. It was just very, we just did a play reading at our school.
Yeah.
And
just with music stands and scripts.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had two experiences with Hunter. He had me play like a dad and All My Sons.
Yes.
A classic American play. I actually wasn't even familiar with the piece. So I was almost cold reading it with Hunter in front of, you know, just a small group of students that had come. And I remember being so moved by the piece and connecting with Hunter that Of Mice and Men was a piece that I had already done and I had played that role and Hunter knew that. I had played it at the Pasadena Playhouse? Yeah, in LA. And so I was really, really familiar with that role. And it's a role that still to this day, it's the last time I was actually on stage performing.
Really?
That experience for me is probably one of the most profound actually. It's one of my top 10 ever because it's just, it's a perfect play and it's tragic. You know,
yes.
On any given night when you have to shoot your best friend, it's just perfectly constructed. It's impossible to not be wrecked by the piece. So,
and even Hunter in that moment, that was probably my favorite thing I've seen him in as well.
100%.
Oh, wow.
It was so just sweet.
But I think we have these sacred moments in
performance. That's a good word. Yeah.
Like, I feel even emotional about it because it's so pure and beautiful, like watching you dance. Because there's so much ego in the performing arts, but then you have a moment where you're like, whoa, I'm watching Lisa just do something so what she's designed to do. And I'm in awe. And the same moment was watching that. And it felt just the sacredness of our art that can move us. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, teaching wholehearted artists and even just working with artists as we have for many years, there's a lot of stuff we have to get out of the way for these pure moments. So initially when you got into acting, I'll segue to sort of stories you've shared, David, of the search for significance. And initially tell our audience, like, what was driving you to perform? Because I think we have these pure moments that are bliss and sacred, but then we have our ego that's driving, you know? So tell me a bit about, what motivated you initially?
You know, it's interesting. I don't know exactly why acting became a search for significance for me. I mean, you know, for all intents and purposes, I had teenage parents, so there was dysfunction and stuff, and there was drugs and alcohol in the house. And I know that maybe to like a Christian audience or to people that have walked, it sounds like, wow, that's just nuts and it's crazy. The irony is I was always pretty safe. I also had my maternal grandmother, my grandmother Judith, who was just like an angel and a godsend. I mean, you know, I came to faith because she prayed me in 100%. So I don't quite know. I don't know if it was just the way that I was wired that I confused feeling like I was made to do something important with significance, because they're not the same thing. But I did. I fell into this trap, and I think it was just the heroine of applause, specifically at an early age, you know, getting applause from your peers, from teachers, getting in the yearbook, you know, all those things that are really like the center of your universe when you're 16, 17 years old. And then it was a fast track. I ended up at a really great conservatory because of some amazing female teachers, Dr. Riley and Peggy, who I got in, and it all happened so quick. I didn't have the tools and the infrastructure to understand what was motivating me. And so then I just hopped in, as most young artists do, chasing the hit again from high school. But now you're in college and your ass is getting kicked because you're getting actual criticism and feedback to grow you. And then the next thing you know, you're in New York. And I was kind of on this whirlwind. I made my Broadway debut naked in front of 2,000 people with Nathan Lane and John Glover and Benjamin Hickey, all these like giants. Again, it was all like this tidal wave I was trying to surf, and it was just ahead of me, ahead of me, ahead of me, ahead of me. And so honestly, it wasn't until my first couple of shows got canceled that finally the wave crashed in my face. And I didn't have words for any of this. You know, this is a lot of like Bethel and kingdom language and stuff, but like, I didn't understand anything about identity or significance. I didn't have language for any of these things. What I knew was that my ass would get kicked on the up and down, almost like my sense of self-worth was tied to the stock market. If I was on a show and the ratings were great and I was making $50,000 a week, I was somebody. Mm-hmm. And then the moment that it ended, it was like a deficit. I was less than nobody. And the mental health attacks and things and the craziness that she had to frankly like put up with and help me walk through. I don't say it mildly, like looking back now, it was kind of like torture.
Yeah.
Something had to die. And unfortunately I put up a fight, which makes it all the much longer and more painful. But man, once that thing died, that need for significance, the always seeking being the center of attention or being the one who talks or the funny guy at the party or whatever, and you risk being boring and invisible and all of that crap just dies. Then you can step on stage and actually just serve the audience, lend your heart and your instrument to a play like of Mice and Men or in Jersey Boys when the gurney passes behind me because the scene is that my daughter is dead. Mm. Then I can just lend this instrument that was given to me to the playwright and the audience. Mm. And frankly, the applause is beautiful, but it's no longer essential. Because the thing that mattered was the moment.
Mm, that's so good. It's so powerful. I think that the price of visibility, like that being, we live in as artists in that simultaneously wanting to hide, mm-hmm. but wanting to be seen.
Yeah.
And I think different personalities have more of a bent. Some personalities actually have it takes them a bit longer than others to yep. kill that significant thing. And I know, Lisa, you're wired very differently, which is so mm-hmm. beautiful. But what did the stage look like for you, you know, initially?
Initially when I got into theater, I was young. I was about 10 years old when I did my first, performance in front of 1,500 people. So it was a very legit, beautiful theater in the Bay Area. And I just loved it. I just thought it was fun. It felt good. And I mean, I was a kid, so I'm thinking it was just fun.
Yeah.
I just loved being a part of something bigger than myself.
Mm.
And I think, you know, my training, I started training at 12. And I think that was because when I was looked around and I was like, okay, I've got to get out of where I am.
Mm-hmm.
And the only place that I was getting any kind of affirmation, any kind of direction was in the performing arts.
Mm.
And so I think that's why I seriously said, okay, at 12, I'm going to train my tush off and I'm going to go do this because I can't stay here.
Mm.
And that's just kind of how it went for me, yeah. you know? And I think that the interesting thing about my life when I look at it is I've always just put one foot in front of the other and, I've always just gone after what I've wanted,
mm-hmm.
not for any outside anything. It's just because I wanted it.
Yeah.
Like there was just something inside me. I'm like, oh, I just have to do this and I want to do that. And I, you know what I mean? It's just like this inner drive.
Yes.
That it's when I feel alive,
mm.
you know? And when I look back at my time when I was professional and on stage, I think that's what I felt most alive. And it's because at that time it took all of me.
Mm.
Like it took everything I had to perform with such excellence,
mm.
mental, physical, heart, emotional, right? It took everything. And then when you're not on stage and when you're living in New York, it takes everything.
Yeah.
It takes everything, you know, it's like your mindset, your heart posture, your drive, your commitment, all our internal world. It really has to be focused and intentional and dialed in.
Mm.
And I think the number one thing is, and I don't necessarily know why, except God, you know, mm-hmm. placed this inside me, but it's having a trust. Like I trusted myself.
Yeah. Wow.
I trusted, you know, I would say, oh, I don't think I ever taught like dream language, like, oh, I dream to be on Broadway. No, it's just like, I want that.
Mm. mm-hmm.
I want to do that.
Yeah.
And the difference between dream and I want that is, it's more detailed and focused.
Yeah.
But it's a commitment going, I will do what it takes to do that.
Yeah. Which you have a ton of grit because even I know some of your story when you were really young, didn't you? You had some physical limitations, right?
Yeah, actually. Oh, good memory. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. Like, yeah. I think I just want to illustrate like how you were so determined and convicted.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about
yeah,
that.
Yeah. Ironically enough, when I was 1 year old, it was the way that I was sitting. My legs were actually kind of starting to you know, as your child, you know, your legs are developing, the way I was sitting was twisting my bones and muscles.
Yeah.
And at this time, the only thing they knew how to do, maybe my parents were young, it's what the doctors told them, so that's what they did, is they broke my legs and they put me in casts. Mm. So there's just a couple pictures of me like crawling around on my arms and me dragging my little legs in a cast. So the fact that, you know, my first love was dancing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm just like, okay. You know? And because when you're in a cast, you have to put your leg in a slight bent. So my legs could never fully straighten. Mm. And I would hear that over and over, Lisa, straighten your legs, straighten. And I'm like, they don't straighten. Like, you know what I mean? And so even like kind of that, oh, you're never going to be able to do this because your legs aren't straight and you're not this and you're that. And I'm like, I don't know. You're a lot of naysayers out there.
Yeah.
And because what was inside is just how to do it.
Yeah. And you give a great good high kick. So those legs are straight, guys.
Right? It doesn't matter. It's high. It doesn't matter if there's a little bent in the knee. But yeah, I guess maybe from early on there was like a little.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's attack against my future or what, but yeah.
Well, I mean, I think just for the audience, like you guys have such beautiful careers and I think it's good for them to know like the opposition that you had. It wasn't just like everything you touch turns to gold. Like you actually had to have grit and focus. And my first ever life coach asked me, when was the moments in your life where you felt most alive? And I listed them out. And I love that you're saying that you felt so alive, because she said, that's where the glory of God is. Mm-hmm. And so whenever I sit in front of someone, I'm looking for where is life? Where is life? Because mm-hmm. God gave us abundant life. And it shows you, like, I'm sure that's where you're like, I'm following that, where I feel alive, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so good.
And I think that. The second most profound time feeling most alive is when I had my children.
Wow.
Because I had three boys and they're all 2 years apart. And the next one is like 21 months apart. So at one point I had three boys under the age of four.
Mm. Wow.
And just those early years of raising them again, it takes everything. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where I feel the most alive is when I can give my all to something.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. Wow. That's so beautiful. I love it. So a lot of artists feel misunderstood. You guys, have you ever struggled with that?
Yeah. And I've been inoculated over the last, you know, 7 or 8 years, because it turns out that whenever you communicate with other human beings, the probability of being misunderstood is about 98.9%. And I think when we say I feel misunderstood, quite often really what we're masking is that we want people to agree with us. Mm. And I think one of the things that I learned from Danny Silk, a guru and a mentor to many of us, is that the goal of communication is not agreement, but the exchange of information. Mm. Man, just that sentence alone will serve you with your children. It'll serve you in your business. It'll certainly serve you in your marriage. If I go into a conversation with her and my goal is to let her know how pissed I am that she's a different human being with a different perspective and, oh my gosh, a different opinion, then we are going to have a mess. Mm. And God help you with teenagers if you go in with that modality. And so this idea of being misunderstood for the artist, I think often translates to, what do you mean you don't like my piece or my work? That's really what we're saying. Misunderstanding, I don't think in those instances you're being misunderstood. I think the world is responding how the world chooses to respond. Sometimes it'll respond with two thumbs up and a smiley face emoji and 50,000 likes. And sometimes, and this is the scariest thing, crickets. Because at least if you get a bad criticism, they showed up and they saw the show.
Right.
My old agent, Ron Ross, God bless him, who passed away. He's the first guy who took a risk on me in New York. He said, well, David, you know, if you believe the good ones, you got to believe the bad ones. And I was like, oh, that's interesting.
That's sobering.
Or I could just walk through life and cherry pick the people who like me and demonize the ones who don't. Mm-hmm. And so I've had people tell me when I did Tin Pan Alley Rag and I played Irving Berlin, literally same show over 4, 5, 6 weeks, whatever. I had the daughter of the man who I was portraying, Irving Berlin's one remaining daughter at the time, flew from Paris to see me perform. In the green room, walks up to me and says, "You remind me of my father." The best compliment ever if you're an actor playing Irving Berlin. I had another review critic who said, "Well, he succeeded at playing the postage stamp version of Irving Berlin." Wow. So I have the daughter of the man telling me I'm her father. I have a critic saying, "Yeah, that was a caricature." So me, this whole idea of being misunderstood, I now assume I'm going to be misunderstood. Yeah. I assume I'm going to have to give a couple of revisions of what it is that I'm saying to you. I'm going to assume that I'm going to have to rewrite things that I direct, or that, because my goal needs to be not so much to be understood as much as if my heart is to lead you on a journey, be it with my performance, my direction, the piece that I'm writing, I would like to have the most people clear on what it is that I'm trying to communicate. So now I put it on me. If you don't understand me, then it's my job to clarify what it is that I'm saying to you. Mm-hmm. And the rest of it is just baby tears and ego.
Yeah. I love how you've just broken that down. And I think your take is so generous and accepting. Like, I think we just are going to be misunderstood.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's good. What about you, Lisa?
For me personally, I don't think I ever thought about being misunderstood. And I think it's because that's a cerebral thought for me personally. Mm. And because I am more kinesthetic, right? And I think in the physical realm and even in spatial, more spatial and physical.
Yeah.
So for me, it was just like, I don't fit in. Why don't I fit in? And then, you know, you go through life and you realize that maybe you just weren't made to fit in. Mm-hmm. Whatever that thought or idea is for me, maybe it's just not true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And so I think as a teacher and, at BCA, I really champion students to don't look outside of you. Don't worry about what I think or another faculty member thinks or a director thinks or what about you? Mm-hmm. And I think it comes from that. Like you can't, because like what Dave was saying, you can't be who everybody else wants you to be.
Yeah.
You can be who you want to be.
Yeah.
And when it comes to even, you know, your art and your creativity and acting or dancing or screenwriter, whatever your art form is, it comes from you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's tapping into that of like, okay, if you wanted to, you know, have a 9-to-5 job, then you wouldn't be an artist. You wouldn't be a creative necessarily. You wouldn't be at BCA going, well, this is what I want to do with my life. Mm-hmm. You would do this as a hobby.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that thing of this like, oh, I'm just maybe slight left of center. I don't fit into that. I don't fit in there. I don't fit in there. It's really just kind of, I don't know, I think a way of looking at it that doesn't serve you.
Yeah, that's so good. I heard a quote that says the opposite of belonging is fitting in. So true belonging is actually, being okay with I don't fit in here.
That's good. And that's true.
It's really true.
Yep.
So I love that you brought that up. And great language, because I love how different we all are, like, and how it manifests.
I think when we're really honest, if we're really honest, we are flipping quirky. All of us. If we're really honest. And this is why we all have those 1 to 3 friends, guys, you know, girlfriends or whatever, who really get you, where you can have your hair down or whatever the metaphor is and just be your weird little self. I think we're all a little odd.
Yeah, for sure. I know. I love it. I love it. I think being a pastor, it's like I hack into people's lives.
Oh, you see it all.
So I'm like,
you see the menagerie of oddness.
Yes. I'm like, that's who you are in there. Uh-huh.
But you also see like some threads through people.
Yeah.
Oh, we're all a little bit like this.
Oh,
we're
sure.
All a little bit like that, which to me is beautiful because it's just like, you're not unique.
Yeah. Yeah.
In that way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's just kind of like, oh, okay, no, I've seen this before. As a pastor, you're like, I've heard this before. Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with this. And that's why you're like, so let me help you through this.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's the biggest thing. To be an artist, to be creative, you don't have to be like so different. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be unique because that doesn't exist.
Right.
It's just like, what do you have to bring to your craft?
Authenticity.
Because that's what doesn't exist. What doesn't exist is you matched up with whatever your project you're doing, scene you're doing, play you're doing. Because that's never been done before.
Mm.
Not that the play hasn't, but you in that hasn't been
done before. In this moment,
And that is like the focus and the heart. And when you pull like Holy Spirit into that, it takes it to a whole nother level.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. Maya Angelou says, you belong everywhere, but nowhere. You belong to yourself.
Mm.
Like,
love that.
And it's such a probably annoying quote because it's so abstract, but it's so valid what you're talking about. Because there's the common humanity.
Yeah.
Like, actually, and because I work through belonging so much with our students, because it's just when you get a group of people together, it's a rumble, like it's a street fight often. So, yeah, but speaking of BCA, and we'll sort of close out our time here, like, just because we've got a few more minutes, but what's hardest, most rewarding thing of building a university? So, hardest thing, most rewarding.
Okay, I'm an optimistic person, so I'm going to go with most rewarding. The most rewarding is when you see the change in people, the growth in people.
Oh, yeah.
The breakthrough.
Yes.
In people, because that they're going to carry for the rest of their lives.
Yes. Great.
And so the flip side of that is, for me personally, the harder is the systems and the organization of certain things.
Because it's academic. So
right. So the academic mixed with the creativity, that's hard, especially from my background of just being a professional in the business now, going, well, how do I grade that? And how do I,
so
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It is. That, and I think that's, that's hard.
Yeah, great answer. What about you, David?
Most rewarding was we had one of our students who graduated, Kelsey Swanstrom. She came over to
the
house.
She's coming on today.
Is she now?
She's coming on my podcast.
So funny. Well, she's just a beautiful person, and she was over having a brunch with us, and she speaks Mandarin, and so she was speaking with Dalita, who was learning Mandarin at the time, and you know, just a sweetheart. And we asked her. We said, "Well, so what's the most important thing that you learned or got out of?" And I think in her case, she was at least 4 years.
She was 4 years,
At BCA. And she said, "I became a better human being."
Oh.
And I thought to myself, Lord, if I don't know if people are going to win Oscars or Emmys or be signed by the most important agent, but this girl here will be forever a different human, wife, mother, friend, because of her journey. Mm-hmm. What can top that? I think the greatest challenge, if you've worked professionally, is to watch students not take advantage of this space to take risks. What I've seen with a lot of young Christians, and I'm still wrapping my head around this, so I don't have it figured out, is that they've learned, in many cases, a beautiful sense of obedience, but a paralyzing one.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so true.
And there's some misunderstanding. I haven't cracked the code or understood, because I think you need to listen to and obey wisdom in your life, in your faith, in people who are smarter and have lived. I mean, why repeat the same mistakes of your fathers or mothers? That's just stupid and foolish. That's not what I'm recommending. But in that moment, I had a teacher, Victoria Santa Cruz, who would play these games with us. And she was Peruvian, and she was a folk dancer, majestic woman. It just completely changed the course of my life. And so we would play these games. And so we would have all these heady acting exercises and Meisner this and Uta Hagen that and scene analysis and all this stuff. And she had this really thick accent, and you'd step up to this jump rope with these two little sticks. And she was not shy, but just smacking you right in your stomach and saying, "Kid, jump, leap. Stop thinking, you know? And you were like, I'm like 18 years old and I want to please this woman. And this rope's coming at me and the rope would feel like a guillotine. And I'll never forget it. My senior year, we got to do this advanced exercise where we now had a like these sticks and a drum machine and steps. And I was just feeling free. I was a senior, senioritis. I didn't care about pleasing Victoria Santa Cruz anymore. And I had this dancer, Sofia Sarguera, who was my partner going up these steps. And we had to do these really complicated rhythms. And all of a sudden, she puts the drum machine on, and I was like, whatever. And we go up the steps and come down the steps. She says, yes, kid, yes. You leapt. You were right here, right now. And that's the thing that's the most frustrating for me, is to know for this kid, this student, you've got these circles, these sacred spaces that we create at BCA. And when they're sitting paralyzed on the sidelines, waiting for someone to tell them what to do, because when you leave this place, no one other than the IRS is going to tell you what to do with your life. And that thing in your gut, that thing that tells you, go, leap, the voice of God, your instincts, that's the thing that I want people to leave with. And it's the saddest when I don't see them leap.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because you can't make them do it.
Nope.
Yeah. It's an internal, it's actually funny because that's usually, I've had a lot of one-on-ones with students talking about self-trust, like you spoke about, like mm-hmm. a conviction of like, okay, I'm hearing all the techniques, but let's just go for it. Let's just mm-hmm. throw it all to the wind and actually trust yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just risk and be get it wrong.
Yeah. Get yeah. it wrong.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Maybe be boring.
Yes.
Maybe people laugh at you. Maybe you look stupid. You just have to go.
All of the above.
Yeah, because it's what we started this conversation with, is none of that matters. It's yes. not what people are thinking or saying from the outside. Mm. You're the one getting up in the morning. It's your life. How are you going to do it that day?
Yeah.
How are you going to do the next day? It's up to you.
Yeah, that's so good. Yes. Well, this has been such a rich time.
Yeah.
Spending time with you guys.
Love you, Ella.
Love you, Ella. And love what you do for our students. I mean, I know for sure that you have dug... If anyone in our environment understands how to get into the hearts and spirits and souls of artists, I'm utterly convinced that you're the one who has the PhD in that, girl. So just thank you for the way that you've loved our students, guided our students, and thank you for putting up with our messiness as well and helping us change a few diapers along the way.
Thanks for putting up with my messiness. I love it. Well, I love you guys so much. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank
you. Awesome.
Thanks for listening today. Please download, share with your friends, and write a review. If you would like to book in a life coaching session with me, go to my website at www.ella-hooper.com or follow me on Instagram at Next Brave Thing Podcast.